The weeks, they're just long now, right? This one in The Economy from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. Friday, the 17th of February. Glad you could be with us, as always, everybody. So much to talk about, so little time, so no dilly-dallying. Huh? Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. The topic at hand, of course, is the economic week that was. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Okay.
So, Lee, let's start. We'll do this roughly chronologically, I guess. Fed Chair Yellen goes to the Hill Tuesday, Wednesday, and says expected things about the economy. Anything catch your ear?
Well, no, just that she's, thinking that a rate hike might come soon, which shouldn't really be surprising to anybody. And, things are looking good. I mean, the job market is looking good. Inflation is even, looking towards its target of 2%. And the risk being that you don't want to wait and then do that suddenly. Right. So, I think all was fine.
All right.
Nothing super surprising.
Sudeep, a different Fed story here. Daniel Tarullo, a member of the Fed Board of Governors, announced this week that he's going to be stepping down come April the 5th, plus or minus, which will leave President Trump with three total seats to fill on the seven-member Board of Governors, two held over from the Obama years. This now gives the president a chance to put his own people in charge of sort of monetary policy.
This is his chance, his big moment to have a Donald Trump Federal Reserve. Barack Obama got to shape one and got years of low interest rates. Whether that was good or bad for the economy and the country and the world is still up for debate. But President Trump has a really, really difficult political decision to make. He says he's a low rate guy. He loves low interest rates. Changing a low rate Fed chair isn't the smartest move to do in that case. So, but his people want a Republican in the job. They want a conservative. They want somebody who will overhaul the Fed. They want people who are going to shake things up. If you are a low interest rate president and want to be able to keep the dollar a little weaker to boost trade and do all the things you want on that front, changing course isn't so smart at this point. The prior two Fed chiefs were reappointed by a president from a different party, so he could do the same, but he'd have to go against a lot of Trump loyalists to do that.
Yeah, Lee, Janet Yellen's term as chair is up in January. She's got more time left on the Board of Governors, but it's a tricky position for the president to be in, right?
It's very tricky, yeah. And I mean, especially, if she lingers around, I think her term is up in 2024 as a governor, and same is true with vice chair Stanley Fischer. So it's an interesting situation.
Yeah.
We don't know what's going to happen. And of course, there's, Tarullo is resigning, and he was the regulatory guy.
Right.
So lots of changes.
All right, let's do a little today in history. And this is a pop quiz I did not brief you all on. 8 years ago today, Sudeep, what happened? 17th of February, 2009.
That was, were we in the stimulus back then? Was
that
the
that's really
pack?
Close. I'll give you that credit. It is the day that President Obama signed, after 29-something days in office, an $800 billion stimulus program. And I bring that up to mention this. And I talked about this last weekend with Cardiff and Catherine, I think it was. The idea that there is so much going on politically and organizationally at the White House that nothing is happening on his key economic programs. Nothing on tax reform, nothing on health care, even though he promises it by the middle of March, nothing on infrastructure. It is remarkable, Lee, is it not?
It is remarkable. But what are you talking about? There's no chaos.
I saw the presser yesterday. I saw that. It's a fine-tuned machine.
This is a fine-tuned machine.
Right.
That's true. But I mean, I think that, I think he'll eventually get to these things. And I think all of the things that are positive that business is taking from his economic proposals are what is fueling the stock market to continue to hit new highs. And I think the things that are of great concern, like the protectionist anti-trade, policy, are still of grave concern.
Yeah, but
Sudeep, there's nothing happening.
Right. But Sudeep, clearly the market still believes that tax reform will happen, as Paul Ryan promised this week. They believe the deregulation. It believes the deregulation will continue, yeah?
Markets love to cling to hope. Investors don't want to change their positions at this point. It's only been a month of the CEO in chief. What we've learned is that entertaining is easier than governing, and running a giant federal bureaucracy is not a whole lot of fun. So he's reverting to the former and hoping the latter will come together. But you can keep hoping for a while until people just start to scratch their heads and wonder, maybe it's not, none of this is going to happen, and we've got to make go to plan B. But we're not there yet.
Yeah, Lee, real quickly in the minute or so we have left, since he was at the Boeing plant down in South Carolina today touring the 787, the new 787 from Boeing, this story that broke this week on Bloomberg, the idea that President Trump had the CEO of Boeing in his office when he called the Pentagon program manager for the Lockheed fighter jet. And it just seems to be another indication of industrial policy not as usual.
Unbelievable. I mean, just and apparently, the you know, Muhlenberg was really taken by surprise. This, yeah, you can just see him sitting there. And I mean, the CEO just kind of, well, Trump just, what does he dial him on speakerphone or something?
Yeah,
I mean,
apparently,
just the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was just so weird. And also just completely breaking that chain of command. This lieutenant general is never supposed to hear directly from the president of the United States. And just with it, you know, it was just really, really seemed very inappropriate and bizarre.
And the Trump presidency is where we are. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine and Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, slow start, slow finish as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Bigger is better. Size matters. Grow or die. Truisms of the global economy, which gets us to today in mergers and acquisitions news. Kraft Heinz, which until just a year ago were two separate companies, have made a $143 billion offer for the Anglo-Dutch consumer goods conglomerate Unilever. Unilever said no thanks. Kraft Heinz said it's going to try again. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has the story.
The reason these giant food and beverage companies are trying to get even bigger, that's an easy way to grow revenues and profits. Peter Cohen teaches strategy at Babson College in Massachusetts.
When they merge, they not only get access to new geographies, which this Kraft Unilever thing would do, but it also allows you to cut a lot of costs.
The bigger you are, the more you're buying, the better the discounts you can negotiate. Cohen says companies can also grow their revenue while getting rid of overlapping costs.
For example, you don't really necessarily need two finance departments, two human resources departments.
The thing is, mergers can be risky. David Garfield is a managing director at A.T. Kearney.
Businesses that combine can lose talent or focus, and if they're not careful, they can have stumbles in day-to-day operations.
Not all firms in this sector are following the mega-merger approach. Procter & Gamble has been shedding brands and business units that aren't performing well. John Graham teaches finance at the Fuqua School of Business.
So I think Procter & Gamble is trying to get rid of the less competitive units, you might say, the less competitive products, and focus on the ones that they think they can charge a higher price for and have this great reputation and ultimately kind of bring more value to the company.
As for Kraft Heinz's bid for Unilever, even if both companies eventually strike a deal, regulators on both sides of the Atlantic would still have to have their say. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
The space part of what NASA does gets all the headlines, but a good chunk of that agency's work is more inward-looking, things like weather and climate change here on Earth. Republicans in Congress are talking about moving NASA away from that research, research that has economic value, as Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
The Earth Sciences Division accounts for about $2 billion of NASA's $20 billion budget. Yesterday, it was in the crosshairs of House Republicans who say much of its climate work is already being done by other agencies and should be moved out of NASA. Ellen Sofan is the former chief scientist for NASA. I caught her as she was driving to North Carolina. She says, yeah, EPA and NOAA do climate work, but
NASA is the only federal agency that builds and develops spacecraft, that works on new instrument technology to understand this planet from that unique vantage point of space. So if you hear someone saying, well, we're going to give this to another agency, it means it's probably going to go away.
Sofan says each project provides more of a clue to Earth's processes.
A lot of this research that I think could maybe be interpreted as climate, we need to make people understand that it's about so much more than that. It's about water security. It's about food security.
And she says business. The reinsurance industry, for instance, they're the people that insure insurers, pays close attention to climate change because of the increased risks of catastrophic hurricanes and floods. James Lynch with the Insurance Information Institute says NASA is important for them, but
they do rely on it, but it's really hard to say that that's the only source that they rely on.
Even so, it would represent less data for assessing risk. Frank Nutter is president of the Reinsurance Association of America.
We hope that the Congress continues to maintain support for NASA and NOAA with respect to weather and climate.
Any budget changes require congressional approval. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg shared some deep thoughts this week, a long, long essay about where he sees humanity going online. We got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So here it is, 5,700-something words from Mark Zuckerberg. Yes, you know, 1.9 billion people use Facebook, but it seemed to me there was no there in this thing, right? There's no action coming out of this?
You know, it sort of remains to be seen what action will eventually come. It's definitely more of a manifesto, I think, about why. Ultimately, it is an argument for why Facebook should be the place that everyone conducts all of their community, all of their interaction. It was weirdly, despite its lack of action, an argument for total global dominance by Facebook.
Okay. Oh, is that all? But here's the thing, right? Facebook is a for-profit company, and it has piles and piles and piles and piles of data on all of us. It is controlled by Mark Zuckerberg. There's nothing soothing in what I just said.
I did not find it particularly soothing. I think that the idea of communities online are really powerful. They have also been around since the 80s, you know, or just a few years later. And so the argument that all of this has to take place on Facebook at the enrichment ultimately of Mark Zuckerberg and the sort of sacrifice of our data is, I think, something that we should take really seriously. We can accomplish on the open web, where you don't have to be a member and turn over all your personal information, almost all of the things that he suggested in that post, and frankly, without the oversight, and there's no other way to put it, censorship, that also happens on Facebook.
This is going to cue right into something you're very interested in, this idea of path dependency now. We're already down the Facebook path, and it's going to be tough to break us out of that.
We are. I think it is exactly Facebook's size and reach that made it such a platform for fake news and viral misinformation during the election and before, and the monetary structures that reward this fast propagation of information. So the idea that we would centralize all of our communities and all of our communications on one platform that is ultimately for profit, that's not something that many technology proponents, including myself, are going to argue for.
Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure.
I'd be remiss here, and the producers would yell at me if I failed to mention the new podcast that Molly and I have, Make Me Smart. It's called Us on the News of the Day, You and Your Questions, interviews as well. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. British Prime Minister Theresa May has till the end of March to get going on Brexit negotiations, but there is going to be another test of the European Union well before that, Monday, as it happens, when European finance ministers meet to consider whether Greece ought to get the next installment of all that bailout money that Athens has been promised. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Has Greece passed enough spending cuts and other measures to merit the next chunk of bailout money? The honest answer, says Greek blogger John Serapoulos, is no. Greece's creditors have demanded some reforms unthinkable for the left-wing government in Athens.
They really want the government to pass a law that makes it possible to perform mass dismissals of personnel.
The creditors want to boost the sale of state-owned companies by making it possible to slim down the bloated payrolls, and they want to further restrict the right to strike.
The left-wing government finds it symbolically very, very difficult to pass these two labour reforms that creditors are now asking for.
Complicating matters further, the creditors are divided over what to do about Greece. The IMF wants to see some form of debt relief, but the German leader Angela Merkel famously said that phrase doesn't sound too good in German. Especially this year it doesn't, when Merkel is seeking re-election. Writing off Greek debt is also unthinkable, says investment manager Stephen Clapham.
if you're a German politician, you do not want to donate money to Greece. After all, German train drivers are not going to vote for you when Greek train drivers are retiring earlier on higher pay.
Greece's Eurozone creditors are in a quandary. Three of them, including Germany, face general elections this year amid a rising tide of Eurosceptic populism. They don't want to be seen letting the Greeks off the hook, but they also don't want to see Greece default, causing Euro turmoil. Joan Hoey of the Economist Intelligence Unit.
I think that there will be another can-kicking exercise precisely because of the elections. The Europeans are not going to allow this to blow up over the next few months, and we'll find some way out, as they usually do.
In other words, pretend and extend. Pretend the Greeks are complying and give them the money. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, by my looking at it, the minimum wage increase has just been a godsend.
That guy right there, he runs a fast food franchise, if you can believe that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 4 points today. Flat. Closed at 20,624. NASDAQ up 24 points, about 0.4%, 58.38. S&P 500 ended things up 3 points, about a 10%, 23.51. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow advanced 1.7%, the NASDAQ up 1.8%, S&P 500 up about 1.5%. Told you earlier about Kraft Heinz and Unilever. Kraft ended the day up 10.75%. Unilever, better even, 13.2%. Other food producers, including Campbell's Soup and Jam Smucker, delivered disappointing sales to investors today. Campbell's Soup was cold, ended the day down 6.5%. Jam Smucker spread a little bit thin, ended things down 1.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've done a couple of stories the past couple of weeks on retirement, the upshot of which has basically been that saving for retirement is really hard because life is expensive. But, and this is not going to be welcome news, things don't get any easier when you actually hit retirement age because you don't know how long you're going to need the money to last, if you take my meaning. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Retirement has a lot of upsides, like not working. But it can also be a really stressful moment for people.
Obviously, the financial thing, you know, we're not exactly sure how much we will need to live on.
Darlene Dickerson is 65. She and her husband in New Orleans are getting ready to retire.
We won't be have the income that we've been used to, so we're going to have to decide which things are most important to us and which things we're willing to give up.
Tough choices abound. And at this point, she's not quite sure what to do with their savings.
Of course, nobody is, because you don't know how long you're going to live. So coming to grips with that is emotionally a little strange.
That question of how long you're going to live is at the core of what many retirees are grappling with. 71% of Americans say one of their top three retirement goals is having enough money to last a lifetime. But how much to spend each year when you don't know how long you're going to be around to spend it?
People really need to, one, accept that this is a really hard financial problem.
Alison Schrager is a pension economist.
I mean, no one ever really talks about this phase of retirement. I mean, everyone's very focused on the saving part and are you in the right funds and are you getting the right advice? But the spend down post-retirement problem is significantly harder.
There are a couple of pieces of conventional wisdom, though.
What most economists say is buy an annuity. Take that wealth, buy an annuity.
Specifically, something called an income annuity. That is where you hand over a chunk of cash, usually not your whole nest egg, but a chunk, to an insurance company after you retire. They commit to giving you a check every month or every year for as long as you live.
The risk of living too long means you have to hold on to all this extra money and underspend. When you buy an annuity, what it is you end up in this pool. Some people live too much longer than they expect. Some people live much shorter. And so the risk can be spread across all these different people.
Economists love this idea. They love income annuities.
No one else feels that way.
It's still a very, very small part of the investment world.
Robert Kersner is CEO of LIMRA, a financial services industry group. On the one hand, he says the income annuity market has been growing as more retirees start to look for ways to hedge against rising lifespans. In 1996, sales were at $2.8 billion.
It'll be about $12 billion in 16.
Big increase, sure, but it still represents no more than 0.2% of retiree savings in the U.S.
We have a lot more education that needs to take place.
Income annuities may need more than that.
Right now, it's a low interest rate environment.
Bruce Wolf directs the BlackRock Retirement Institute. The insurance company you give your savings to uses it to make money and pay you a monthly check. Low interest rates mean they aren't making much money, so those checks people get are lower than a lot of people would like. Interest rates may rise in the future, and that might improve sales. But the other issue is it's just really hard psychologically to hand over a piece of your savings to some financial services firm.
When you talk to people about the characteristics associated with an annuity, people find them very attractive. But then when it gets to the point of having to make that kind of lifelong commitment, people seem to back away.
And financial planners say giving up a piece of your savings in exchange for guaranteed income also has an opportunity cost for people. Scott Benner is with Kutcher, Rhodes & Benner, a financial planning firm.
In exchange for the certainty they're getting, they're giving up a lot of return.
It can seem alluring to put your savings into the market in one way or another to get returns there, which is why a lot of planners say, well, talk about it with a financial planner. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
One of the topics that will surely come up in Alexander Acosta's confirmation hearings, he is, remember, the new nominee to be Secretary of Labor, is minimum wage. The conventional wisdom for a lot of Republicans is that minimum wage increases are bad for business. In California, though, where the minimum wage has been rising for more than 2 years now, there is a fast food CEO who thinks the change has been great for his business. And as Sam Harnett reports from KQED, he says he has got the data to back it up.
CEO Bill Phelps says his thoughts on minimum wage have evolved. In 1994, Phelps co-founded Wetzel's Pretzels, which has almost 100 outlets in California.
Like most business people, I was concerned about it a couple years ago when California started raising the minimum wage.
That was back in 2014. Phelps worried increasing wages for his employees would cut into profits, and that if he raised prices to compensate, fewer people would come eat and sales would drop. But something else happened entirely.
I was shocked. I was stunned by the business.
Sales at his California stores immediately shot up. The same exact thing happened in 2016. A wage increase by the state led to a bump in business. Now, Phelps is convinced.
The increases in the minimum wage have been good for my business, and the data would support what I've said.
Phelps says you can see why at the Wetzel's Pretzels franchise in Concord's Sun Valley Mall. The mixer here bangs dough all day long to keep up with demand. Business has been good, says franchise owner Mike Jacobs. More people are coming in, and they're buying more.
My overall sales were something like 15% ahead for after the first minimum wage bump, and now they're about 12% ahead this year. It isn't because I'm such a great manager, a smart guy, but the buying public has more money in their pocket.
Now, this could all be coincidence. Maybe California's economy happened to jump at the same exact times the state raised minimum wages. Maybe the franchise owners all started doing something to bump sales. Most Wetzel's locations are in malls, where there are lots of low-wage workers around. No economist has pored over the company's data. UC Berkeley economist David Card says many of his colleagues have long suspected rising minimum wages could increase fast food sales. But no one could prove it, because American companies rarely give out information like the Wetzel's Pretzels sales data.
This fills the gap. And there's been a lot of speculation. No one's been able to figure out how to obtain the data.
Card says this is a big problem when it comes to the minimum wage debate. We don't have good data to understand the whole picture. Even so, Card says, some economists continue to say rising minimum wages are bad for the fast food business.
Yes, sir. Welcome to Wetzel's Pretzels.
At the mall in Concord, store owner Mike Jacobs doesn't need an economics case study to know he's been doing well.
By my looking at it, the minimum wage increase has just been a godsend. My income this year will be double what it was in 2013.
and he's already putting that money back into the economy.
I've been buying more expensive guitars, so, you know.
Jacob says everybody's a winner. His employees get a raise, CEO gets big numbers, his customers can buy more pretzels, and he can buy more guitars. In Concord, California, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, and I don't know how I missed this, but the Monopoly thimble will soon be no more. Hasbro decided to hold an open vote on which pieces to kill off and which new ones to add. 4 million-something people voted, by the way. And so, thimble, we hardly knew ya. Gotta wait, or ye, I suppose. Gotta wait till March 3rd to find out what the new one's gonna be. I was a race car guy. All right, we are out of here. The Dow up 4 points today. We'll call that flat. The NASDAQ up 24 points, about 0.4%. S&P 500 ending things up 3 points, about 0.1% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.